had these really, really early experiences of seeing a shadow moving by the side of the bed. What I remember or perceived as a dog, a black dog.
One theory of the entire paranormal is actually just a sort of a tilling of the soil. It's bringing that which is hidden to light. You know, something is boiling away from underneath that needs to be brought to our attention.
Art at its best is supernatural. And you have to have, you know, you have to believe in it in order for it to produce its effect.
Artists are antennas for new ideas and are fueled by worlds beyond themselves. The creative process can't exist in a vacuum. It exists in conversation with everything else. I'm Laurent John. I work at Somerset House in the studios. And in this second series of The Process, we provide a platform for those conversations. Each episode, we follow artists as they explore one idea from their practice to see where it ends up. We trace their journey as they talk to other thinkers about a question they're exploring at the moment and what it says about the creative process.
My name is Elizabeth Bernholtz, and I'm a composer and musician making music under the name of Gazelle Twin.
In this first episode, we join Gazelle Twin as she sits down to write her next album, all about her long-held fascination with ghosts.
So many stories are like hooded figures, hooded monks. The stuff that I love is just this bloke in like contemporary sportswear running up the steps of this basement pub, I think it was. I love that. I love the idea of ghosts and trainers.
Elizabeth was commissioned to make a sound piece for the horror show exhibition at Somerset House, co-curated by Ian Forsyth, Jane Pollard and Claire Catterall. As the show launched and she returned to the writing process, she found herself drawing on her fear of the paranormal as a sort of fuel for creativity.
If I were to find a thread that ran through all of the albums that I've made since 2010, I would say that they're all connected by fear. It's become a source. It's a very rich source, you know, to sort of stare your fears in the face and give them a face as well. Get down your obvious. Get down your obvious. Get down your obvious. Get down your obvious. You know, a lot of the stuff that I think about and sing about is deeply uncomfortable and troubling. Yet the process of putting that into some sort of allegorical narrative is something close to a type of therapy. I could even look at it as a sort of exorcism.
Don't know how to feel when you want to break all the things you love, thinking it's okay, cutting into flesh till that it returns. Everything is black now that you confess.
Even if I'm trying to write an album about one thing, what comes out is something completely different. So I just go with that now. I kind of just dive into it. In my last album, Pastoral, I performed in an amalgamated sort of jester costume and sang in various different voices, which to me reflected English identity that at the time I really needed to purge. Much better in my day, 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 it was much better in my day. I'm working on my new album now, which is very much from a place of childhood fear. And in the last couple of years, I decided that that album theme was going to be about ghosts. So when Ian and Jane invited me to create a commission for the horror show, I was thinking quite literally about the idea of witchcraft and kind of researching into the history and the horror of witchcraft. And you could easily connect these two things together. You know, the early spiritualism was you know, was often focused on women who had the powers to channel these forces. So there's loads of connection between these two things.
All kinds of ills that ever may be. In Christ's name, I conjure ye.
But I mean, really, like this album, I think partly it's taken me so long because it's so huge. And I really am just like sitting here just thinking, God, what am I doing? Like, what is it? And it's messy. It's messy. You know, you can't tidy that up until you've gone through the process of like this. The paranormal is something I've always been captivated by since childhood. And there are things that I encountered in my first childhood home. As I've grown into an adult, that fascination hasn't really tired, and it's only actually become more obsessive. What I really want to explore in this podcast is what happens when you take the paranormal seriously. From a literal sense, to find out more maybe about what was happening when I was a kid, but also in a lateral sense, how it can connect to culture and then back into my own process as an artist and why I make work. I wanted to actually speak to somebody who works in the world of the paranormal. And through a Twitter contact, I found Inna Smith, who is a paranormal investigator in real life and works for the Scottish Society for Paranormal Research.
These experiences, they are really exciting and they are really interesting, but they're scary. And so really, I see my main job is to take the fear out of it, if I can.
I wanted to ask him about what he does and what he made of my childhood experience.
When I started off investigating the paranormal, I thought it was my job to decide whether something happened or didn't happen, something was real or not. But basically, I've made peace with the fact that there's no way that I'll ever know. I'll never gather evidence of a sufficient quality and value to convince a skeptic. It's not that sort of investigation. It's more like counselling. I describe myself as a ghost social worker.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. It's really interesting because it seems like just reading through some of the cases that you've been involved in on the SSPR website, just so many of them are happening in an environment where there's already some trauma or maybe a kind of, you know, really high stress levels. And it's interesting to me how these things cross, but also how what the work that you do is about mediating that. For me, I've been thinking about the paranormal my whole life. I've always been interested in it from all angles. I'm someone that grew up in a house that was very much accepting of paranormal phenomena and where ghost stories and hauntings were kind of part of my childhood growing up. They were present in my first childhood home. I had these really, really early experiences of seeing a shadow moving by the side of the bed in my parents' room where I would end up each night. And I would watch what I remember or perceived as a dog, a black dog, moving around by the bedside on my side or on top of a wardrobe near their bed. But with no fear at all, no sense of fear until I was much older. So at that age, I would have been about three, four or five. And then it wasn't until I was about 12 years old, I began to sort of hear stories about that from my brother and his experience of the dog in my parents' room. And then my father's experience of the dog that he felt on him in the night, growling at him. I've never sort of stopped thinking about that and wondering what it could have been. So I was just wondering what it is you would do in that situation. Had we investigated it, had we called someone in like yourself, what would have been the process of that?
Well, essentially, it's my job just to speak to you, to gather an account. So going on, I would ask everyone in the house to keep a diary, a record of their experiences. And also, we could explore some possible different interpretations as to what those experiences might be. You probably have looked into this, and and realised what a rich seam even the symbolism of the black dog is. Black dogs, traditionally these sorts of phantoms that haunt lonely rural highways or paths. They could be nature spirits. Some people think they're malevolent with red glowing eyes. Other people attribute to them sort of a nature spirit, like they have this sort of essentially neutral. If you're nice to them, they're nice back. Even accounts of people out in the wilderness who are lost being led back to the path by a black dog. So it's really interesting. It's just like maybe it's something about the building or the property itself. It remembers that animal being there and under particular circumstances and to particular people. It kind of replays this memory of this animal. But I'm going to put on my skeptical hat for a short period here. The fact that it was discussed amongst family members, always got to be careful about essentially planting false memories. Essentially, from a sort of psychological or a sceptical point of view, the idea is chicken and the egg. What comes first, the belief or the experience? Sure enough, the people that believe more in the paranormal have more paranormal experiences in these places. And that's not a surprise. You'd expect that to happen. But the flip side is, maybe the experiences come first. Maybe they have those beliefs because they have those experiences. And the fact also that things will happen in a bedroom when people, the very place where people sleep, from a sceptical point of view, of course it's very easy just to dismiss all of these experiences as some kind of hypnopompic or hypnagogic experience, you know, that sort of those liminal states in between waking and sleeping. You know, people say that this is the orthodox view, or this is the way things are. But if you've had, you know, a so-called impossible or inexplicable experience, you're more open to saying, maybe there's another way. And to tie it into sort of macro political terms, way more interest in the paranormal during periods of political upheaval and change.
I've kind of, I really appreciate the insight. I think it's something that I'm only just coming to now, is to start to think more critically, more skeptically, more scientifically about and psychologically about how all of this stuff plays into experience. And for me, it's the stuff that comes, the stuff that interests me the most is the stuff that happens in the least scary kind of situations possible. So I think we've already hit on the domestic setting being one of the most sort of common places for these encounters and experiences to happen. I'm just wondering if you have any ideas about why that might be.
Presumably the short answer is where people are. And the answer could be it's where the people are that are the experiencers, the witnesses. But it's also perhaps where if your argument is that ghosts or spirits of the dead, it's where people lived. What I think is quite curious as well, though, there seems to be a disproportionately high amount of hauntings that take place in corridors and stairways, which I always find really fascinating because people don't actually really spend that much of their life there. So I think there's something curiously sort of metaphorical. The ghosts themselves seem to be in this in-between sort of liminal space. And there was a theory, it's probably one that lots of people are familiar with now, but basically this sort of infrasound theory of haunting. It was suggested by Vic Tandy that basically infrasound, so very low frequency sound, round about the sort of 19 to 21 hertz, that basically so these low vibrations get funneled along corridors and basically sort of interfere, bounce back and forth and create these standing waves. So this vibration builds up and people that walk through this vibration have this unsettling feeling, because the idea is that, you know, 19 to 21 hertz induces a feeling of anxiety, and it also happens to be the resonant frequency of the surface of the eyeball, so it can actually make you see things as well. So there's that idea that sound can create ghosts.
There's a sort of rational or scientific idea that hauntings are no more than some kind of low frequency. The reason is noise. But I like both of those things. I like the reason is noise and it's supernatural. Do you know what I mean? Mm.
It was really interesting to hear Mark Leckie's take on this infrasound theory.
It's like, yeah, noise is supernatural. That feeling is, well, that's what I'm interested in, is like that feeling that gets produced, and I'm not interested in the explanation of it. I just value that experience, I guess.
Mark is an artist and musician who works mainly in video and sound, often using samples or found footage. And he has a really fascinating take on magic and folklore. I first got in touch with Mark a few years ago, and we were talking about a shared appreciation for the Jonathan Miller adaptation of O Whistle and I'll Come to You on the BBC, and just how terrifying that is as a piece of film, as well as sound design. I really wanted to talk to Mark about the way he uses sound and sampling in relation to the idea of the paranormal. And in particular, an experience he had as a child, which led him to create the show O Magic Power of Bleakness at the Tate Britain in 2019.
When I was a kid of about eight or nine, we used to hang around under this motorway bridge, like on the Wirral. So it was the M53, it's huge. So you're underneath it, and it's this massive concrete edifice. And underneath it was a alcove, there was a slope, and you could go and sit under this alcove. And me and my mates would sit under there.
Stock, stock, stock,
stock.
Think you're better than us.
Might be all right for you, but it's not for us.
He's away with the fairies, lad.
Away, away.
Ah. Away, away.
And that's in the 1970s. Jump to the mid-80s, and I was doing my English O-level, and they said, write a story, a composition about an early childhood memory.
Me?
Back again. Where you been?
And I was like, I know, I'll write about that time I saw a pixie under the motorway bridge.
Who's there?
Giles.
Who's there? What? I see you.
Come on. Take my hand.
And basically what I described was I turned to my left, to my right, and there was a small figure at the end of this alcove, and it was wearing the most kind of ridiculous, almost like in a mocking or ironic way. It was dressed as a fairy, as a pixie. It had a hat on with the bell on the end and the curly red shoes. And it was like it was aware of its kind of ridiculousness. In this story, I didn't think of it as particularly malevolent. Not a particularly benign entity either.
It's unbelievably me.
What happened to it?
Where you been?
What happened to you?
What happened to me?
Where have you been?
Where you been?
What happened to me?
As I was writing it, I realised up to then, I just stored it in my memory in the same way that, you know, my sister got hit by a car. I fell through a neighbour's plate glass window. I saw a pixie. You know, my favourite teacher was Mrs. Sheard. And as I was writing this story out, I realised that, I don't know, the impossibility of it. And I broke the spell. Whatever belief I'd had in that story just evaporated.
That was
what the piece of the tape was about. But, I mean, I kind of used it as a device to be able to talk about class, really. So it was more about that than it was about the supernatural.
What?
Three, what? Yeah, bite it.
Just steal it.
Eat the candy. Stick.
I was really interested. That mention of class was going to ask you about, actually, and like the way you talk about the relationship between folklore and class and how it's kind of relegated to something, you know, for sort of certain types of culture to put into a very, you know, a cliche or you know, kind of something kitsch or something kind of quirky. And I feel like the same sort of happens with anything paranormal or supernatural. When you talk about it, you know, people glaze over, not necessarily taken seriously, even though it can be something deeply terrifying that changes you forever, or it can change your life. So I don't really know what the question is. I suppose I'm asking what you think about the idea of that those things being branded and kind of not taken seriously.
You know, the problem for me is always speaking outside of your experience and trying to convince people who believe that their experience is universal, i.e. the middle classes. And, you know, you have to convince them that there are other experiences in this world, that there's other kind of ways of comprehending the world, right? And folklore, I guess, kind of binds those two things together. And that's kind of what folklore is. I think you have to regard it in some ways yours and be quite possessive about it. And it's made you who you are.
Hearing Mark talk about the link between the supernatural and class was really fascinating, and it kind of made me think about how early spiritualism is related to feminism and just how those otherworldly practices enabled women to have a kind of powerful role in society where they were mostly sidelined. So I wanted to ask Innes what he thought about that as well, and how he thinks women might have been empowered by these beliefs.
There's actually swathes of scholarship on this, because it's most certainly a factor from a sort of historical or sociological point of view, especially feminism and spiritualism. So many of the leading lights of spiritualism were women, and funnily enough, they often preached the voices from beyond, preached equality and justice for the oppressed. What I think is quite curious as well, though, is girls and poltergeists. It's almost like poltergeists is an externalization of suppressed rage that can so often peak at this onset of puberty, which is this unleashing of sexual energy that erupts or explodes and either causes these things directly, or for that matter, as was indeed sort of described in the Enfield poltergeist case, sort of leaks out of the family and then is essentially exploited by these entities that are essentially reanimated by this sexual energy. And so there is that idea that this notion that somehow the more violent hauntings are essentially, in fact, this is one theory of the entire paranormal is actually just a sort of a tilling of the soil. It's bringing that which is hidden to light.
I'm seeing a relationship between this kind of idea of looping and trauma and PTSD loops in us, it loops in our bodies until we face it. And then there's this sort of idea that, you know, some types of hauntings are almost like this thing on loop, this kind of trauma on loop.
Pan 5.
And I was sort of trying to connect that also to the, you know, the way that you use video and sound and archive footage and things like that. And there's this kind of, I feel like there's a connection between those three things, maybe.
Oh.
I mean, I've read this. I can't remember where I read this from. I wrote this down for this. Trauma as a source of transcendence. Talking about the idea that trauma actually is a kind of productive energy, I guess. I'm not looking for transcendence. I'm looking for... I like this idea of immanence, which is like, you know, transcendence is a kind of escape, is a kind of exit, and immanence is kind of to go everywhere, right? Or, and to remain on this earth, right? That kind of equation between that you can convert your trauma into something transcendent or imminent or whatever is kind of why I make art. I'd be hesitant to use the word trauma, but like, whatever, you know, an endlessly repeating narrative, right? I feel that art can kind of expel. I've got another line that I like. Now, I really like this line a lot, which is, I was reading this book about islands, and they talked about the ecology of an island is kind of develops through what they call amplification by compression, i.e. it's very small and tight, and it gets weirder and weirder or stronger and stronger because it's amplified because it can't leave the island, right? But I like that idea when it comes to like making or thinking about these things. So what I do is I take these loops and I compress them and I try and amplify them until whatever magic they have or whatever hold they have on me is kind of like destroyed or kind of...
That's interesting.
Like an like a self-exorcism.
Yeah.
All those bad vibrations, all the super ghouls and ghosts that linger and cling. Magic and out morbidity. Oh, magic power of bleakness. Out indwelling spirit, newman of the northwest. Stagnant entity of dank decades. Out this hollow resonance, void of holy imminence. Reliquary of the 20th century, embalmed in Lucasade. Out this path, standing in a hole.
But you know, it doesn't really work. but it makes me feel better and actually stops me getting depressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I relate to that a lot. I think I definitely relate to the exorcism sort of thing. And I didn't realise that music could offer up those possibilities, but because I've always been drawn to art and film that's done those things, but not really so much music. And then it's just ended up being the way that I go about things too. And I think the idea of sort of facing fear and giving it a face, maybe the sort of audio work on Oh Magic Power of Bleakness is really interesting. Is sound, because I think talking about sound is really, and music is quite interesting in this context.
It's interesting to hear you talk about art and books. You're drawn to them, but you didn't think, you said something about, but you didn't think that you could do that in music. And I'm coming from I find this a lot at the moment. I'm coming from the other way. I'm finding I'm moving from art more towards music because I think music provides a way out of a lot of the problems of art. I grew up with music and I had to learn art, right? And that's still a kind of problem for me, is that art is always about a kind of, it's about a learning, and it's about an academic learning, and in a way that music is not. It's both fascinating and also it does something to your body, so it affects you, you know, on an intellectual level, but also it's doing something to your body that's very pre-cultural.
Yeah, it comes back to the rhythm, doesn't it?
Exactly.
It comes back to repetition and the connection that it makes with your body. And we both use samples in our work. Do you see, or could you see sampling as a form of haunting or as a kind of ghost?
Yeah, definitely. So the piece that I made that is all found footage is Fiorucci Made Me Hardcore. And that's, I made that in 1999. And a couple of years ago, I made a version of Fiorucci, which is ghosted or something. And basically, I found the original VHS tape I'd made it on. And I got two VCRs and I recorded onto another tape and then back again. And I basically just dubbed it back and forth till it became almost destroyed, disintegrated. Even if I watch Fiorucci now, it's like you watch the stuff from the 1970s and, you know, most of them probably aren't here anymore. So you are literally watching ghosts. It becomes closer to something like The Shining or something. Because I think it's something to do with sampling, which is about your using these moments, these concrete moments of time. And that's why they are haunted, because they contain time. Art at its best is supernatural. And you have to have to believe in it in order for it to produce its effect. You can't be agnostic.
Looking back on this podcast, it's really helped clear the fog a little bit for me in terms of revealing really strong connections between formative personal experiences, such as supernatural experiences, and how they can relate to much wider contexts, cultural contexts, psychological contexts. And for me, I was kind of, this album about ghosts has ended up being a bit of an album about depression and maybe about feeling other throughout life. And I feel like maybe the supernatural has that quality where if you feel othered in some way in life, I feel like the supernatural invites a kind of place to recontextualize yourself a bit, and how, as artists, we can spend our lives trying to make sense of that.
Thanks to Elizabeth, and good luck with the rest of the album. Thanks to ghost hunter Innes Smith and to artist Mark Leckie. If you're in London, the horror show is up for another few weeks until February 19th at Somerset House, and it's really worth checking out. The theme music for the series is by Car Beard, and music for this episode is by Gazelle Twin. The Process is produced by Alana Chance for Somerset House, and I'm Laurent John.
I've always known that AI erases, that AI doesn't see me.
Next episode, we'll be looking at the culture of secrecy in AI with artist Morgan Quaintance.
How can you work with AI when nobody's going to talk to you about it?
Asking who these technologies erase, and looking at the effect on our collective memory.
There's a big chunk of human history that's lost, and the technology is perpetuating that.
See you next time.